Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, where we're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. It is always a pleasure to come your way and bring you these programs talking about New Paradigms for a New World. Today, we're going to talk about an aspect of our society that actually, I think, transcends this specific area we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking with Lori Lazon, if I got that pronounced correctly.
Mazon.
She is the president and chief coaching officer at Sounding Board Incorporated, the website soundingboard.com. We're going to talk about her latest work. It's called Leadership Revolution. It is the future of developing dynamic leaders. First question out of the box, Lori. Sometimes I will go off and I will give all kinds of wonderful examples of this, that, and the other thing to get to my point of asking the question. I'm not going to do that this time. I'm just going to ask you the question. What? Because we all can point to different quote unquote leaders. What is in this new revolution? What is a leader? And maybe counter that with what was the quote unquote typical leader? And what in business, government, or does it matter?
It doesn't really matter. A very simple definition of a leader is a person that other people want to follow. You're not really a leader if nobody is following you. Right? So if you apply that in a business setting, and if you're a leader and using a very old style command and control, my way or the highway sort of thing, people are not going to want to follow you. You're using force. You're making them follow you. To me, that's not leadership, right? That's not leadership in a way we would hope to have it happening. So the new paradigm is really how to be a leader that creates the kind of experience and relationship that people want to participate in. And whether it's government, nonprofit, your community, or business, you know, you have to get work done as a leader through and with others. That's the whole point of leadership. You can't do it by yourself or you wouldn't be in a leadership role. So how do you do that successfully without having to control and force people so they're unhappy and they're resisting and they're, you know, not wanting to do what you want them to do? And everybody in business knows, like, the number one reason people leave a company is because of their relationship with their manager. So if that person isn't operating in a way that's engaging and involving that employee, they're going to leave. And it's been causing just a massive retention problem for companies.
Now, in my early days, early days being the 1980s.
That was my early days too.
Yes. I was the operations manager for a religious radio station. And I recognized at one point that my managerial style, quote unquote, leadership style, I could describe it in one word, Hitlerian. And it didn't work.
Yeah.
Because I was asking people to do things because I wanted them done. And yes, that's kind of how I put it. I'm the manager, and I got my comeuppance with one of our my coworkers. Not employee. He was always, I have never had employees. I've always had coworkers because I've always done the same job they had.
Yeah.
And I asked him to do this particular task. I mean, and we had no cleaning service. So, hey, we, the staff had to clean the bathroom and the sink and that, blah, 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 blah. And I asked him to do that. And he said, no. And I said, what? He says, no, I'm not going to do it because you want it. So I thought about it for a minute. I said, okay, we have a lot of programmers who come into the building who do their shows, and they would really appreciate it if we had a nice, clean bathroom so that, you know, they could feel more comfortable when they're on the air and so forth. So they didn't have to think about, you know, the dirty, you know, I mean, it's, we don't want a restroom like an old rest stop out in the middle of nowhere. Okay. And he said, okay, I'll do it because we're doing it for them, but not because you're asking.
Now, right.
He and I got along just fine. I mean, and we did before and after that.
Yeah.
But there was that little glitch there. And I learned, oh, I can't do this way. This does not work. Cause then I'm going to end up doing everything.
Right. So what a great insightful moment there, yeah. Which you found out, like, if you talk about the why of the activity that you want and you frame it in a larger frame of reference beyond yourself, people are willing to jump in. They want to help naturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a great learning. So by the way, why do we need to have a leadership revolution? Because there's still way too many people who are leading like it's 1980.
Some of them even earlier than that.
Yes, for sure.
It's really unfortunate. And I wish that there were a way. Now, do I want to get rid of these people? Of course not. You know, they have a right to be here just like the rest of us. But it sure would be nice if they would wake up a little bit and realize that their managerial style, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
I had a manager who hired me. Now, this was another radio station I worked for. And I am not I have never been a salesman in radio. It's not something I would actively pursue. I've done sales. My father told me once that I could sell ice cubes to Eskimos. So I went to apply for this one job as the program director of a station. They already had one, but he wanted to hire me in the sales department so that I was within the company because he was going to fire the current program director. Now, it didn't dawn on me until after I'd been hired in the sales department that if he could do this to that guy,
right.
He could do it to me.
Yep.
Anyway, when he hired me, he treated me as if I was his best friend.
Yeah.
After he had let this other guy go, and by the way, the other program director and I got along famously. He knew exactly what was going on. He didn't hold it against me. And he actually supported and helped me through the transition.
Wow. Good for him.
But after that, the general manager treated me as if I had just killed his best friend. I mean, you talk about a hostile work environment. I was hiding in the production room.
Wow.
Because I didn't want to deal with him. And finally, I did finally get up the courage to go into his office and say, what's going on? Why are you treating me like this? I got no response.
Yeah.
I found out later the reason why all of this was going on, but I won't go into that right now. In terms of your interest.
Well, let me just say something about that, though.
Go ahead.
Which is, you know, back in the day, the work environment was so very different. For one thing, you had a smaller number of generations in the workforce. So one approach could work for basically everybody. Now you have six generations in the workforce. And as you're suggesting, the younger generations are not really appreciating a more authoritarian style of leadership. And the other was, it was much more homogenous back then. And, you know, now we have a lot of different diversity happening in the workplace, not just generational, but gender and ethnic and religious background. That's causing, again, this need for leaders to have, you know, a multitude of approaches, not just one approach that works for everybody.
Yeah, it is interesting how we have transitioned into this new space, this new, I mean, we're in the 21st century, and I still don't understand, and this is not necessarily a subject that we're going to talk about, but I didn't understand it when I was a teenager finding out about this during the height of the Equal Rights Amendment attempt. And I don't understand to this day how it is possible for a company to hire male and female employees. They do exactly the same job and the women get paid less. I have never, ever understood that whatsoever. But again, that's a whole nother
That is a whole nother topic. And again, it is kind of mind-boggling that it would still be operating that way.
Yeah. I mean, come on, we're in the 21st century. Good Lord.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. My point. We're in the 21st century. Why are we still operating like it's the last century?
Yeah. Lori Mazon's my guest here on Tell Me Your Story. We are talking about leadership. That's right. Leadership. We're talking about what it takes. We're going to talk about what it takes to be a leader. The title of her latest work is called Leadership Revolution. The subtitle is The Future of Developing Dynamic Leaders. Now, we know what good leaders and bad leaders are like. I mean, we're inundated daily. There was I think it was like a 60 Minutes piece. And I loved this piece too. It was really cool. Where this one gentleman, and I want to say he was either first generation or he might have been an immigrant. And he was up in the, the Northeast. And he wanted to open up a yogurt company. And he found a building. He found a plant. But he was not going to hire people and just pay them a wage or a salary. And they'd come in and do their job and go home and so forth. So he set it up as to make the employees basically invested in, or vested, maybe that's the right word, in the company. Are we seeing any kind of change in the attitude towards the, the only way to put it is the people at the top, in terms of realizing that if it weren't for the people below them, I was going to say people at the bottom, but it's everybody below the person at the top, that it's the people below them that are actually the ones that really generate the revenue as well as the product or service. And it isn't the guy at the top that's doing it, might be managing, might be doing this, that, and the other thing. But I'll be honest with you, I don't think it justifies a 7 or 8 figure bonus or income. I don't know how they justify that, but hey, you know, that,
yeah,
again, another subject for another day. But what about that in terms of the attitude towards corporations or even mid-size businesses? Beginning to realize how important these individuals are to their life and livelihood.
Yeah, I would say that is not happening, although there is segments. For example, like I have a startup, so all employees are vested in the company, and we've invest our contractors and vendors into the company as well. Obviously, because we're a leader development company, we have to walk the talk.
Yep.
But right now, there is the largest gap between CEO pay and individual contributor pay that there has ever been. So no, I actually don't think the people at the top are realizing that all those rest of the people are making their living for them. And there's, we used to call it back in the day, again, less CEO disease. Like, you get to some level in the organization and you start to think you're all that. And that you should get paid all that as well. And it's kind of easy and just human nature in a way to forget that, wait a minute, you couldn't do all that without everybody that is helping you. So one nice thing, I have seen a bit of a trend more in mid-sized businesses that are starting to take the ESOP approach, where employees then become owners in the business, even though they're not publicly traded or don't have equity to share. So it's a private company approach to creating more like a cooperative style. But remember, everything cycles. Like, if you remember back in the before the 80s and the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of these cooperative kinds of operations, like the bakery and the grocery store and all of that. People bought in and had an ownership. And then that fell out of favor, like in mid 80s to recently. And now it's starting to pick up again, especially in the last couple of years when it was hard for companies to hire. Now they have to have something that's a little more enticing. Unfortunately, the little shift in the economy right now is making hiring easier. And so, you know, without that pressure, I think it'll unfortunately kind of slide back because the decisions are being made financially versus from a leadership perspective. And it's like a short term versus long term thing, right? Short term, I might lose money, so I have to change. But long term, you're going to build a company of value if you get your employees invested in the company.
I have to say, one of the things that has always intrigued me in terms of my position over the years as pretty typically operations manager has been the fact that I have done the very tasks that the people that I am, quote unquote, supervising or working with are doing. And it actually made it easier for me to communicate and delegate and relegate and so forth without, you know, undue pressure, because it was like my dear friend, my best friend of 53 years, he worked in the bookstore industry, Barnes and Noble. This is when they were, you know, back in the 70s and 80s and so forth. And he would even tell his employees when they scoffed at cleaning the toilet, he would basically say, look, I clean the toilet. And yeah, if I can clean the toilet, so can you.
Yeah.
So it was real interesting the way he and I would communicate and talk about these different things. He had a more direct connection with his employees because he would work directly with them, whereas I was working with the employees. However, that we were on shift, and one station, the Christian station in the 80s and early 90s, they were 8-hour shifts. Those were long days. But I loved it. It was a lot of fun. We're talking with Lori Maison, and we're talking about the leadership revolution, which I don't believe, Lori, includes any active aggressive protests across the country. I'm curious as to this newfound, it's not really so new, interest primarily, I guess, with politicians, but others as well, in this concept of unions. I always joked about how I would unionize, but then I realized that the states that I worked in, Arizona and California, you could give that a shot, but it's a right to work state, both of them. And they will just get new people. They'll let you go and hire new people. But then there were times when I was the only one. And it was more of a joke that I was going to unionize and so forth. But what about this aspect of in terms of a leader and recognizing this aspect of the importance of employees, or again, as I've said, coworkers, and attempting to, through in my case, upper management above me, hey, here are some things that we really, really need. And then, of course, then the question of morale comes up, and so forth. And obviously wage, working condition. I mean, all of these different things have to be addressed by the leaders.
Yes. So that, you know,
about that.
Well, the purpose really of a union, when you get below the details, is to try to equalize the power. Because what happens in larger organizations and even mid-sized, the power starts to concentrate at the top. Mm-hmm. And if you put an individual in the middle or bottom of the organization face to face with someone at the top, the one at the top has the power. They have the power to hire and fire. They have the power to set your wages. They have the power to set your work. So individual to individual, it's an uneven playing field. Mm-hmm. So what unions do is they try to balance the power by having a collection, a group of people on one side, matching the power of the folks at the top of the organization. The downside to that is often then there becomes a power struggle. But the possibility is because the power is equalized, they could have, you know, a rational, useful conversation where they're assuming equal power and come up with some collective decisions that are actually in the best interest of everybody. It's hard to get there because human nature is power hungry. And, you know, everyone's always trying to get to the top of the hill. But you have to understand a business and a work environment is actually a collective environment. Just having people in power always win doesn't mean your organization's going to be successful. Yeah.
The question has often been asked, and of course, I living here in Santa Barbara, I know that as far as the nonprofits, we have the largest number of nonprofits per capita of any place else in the country. But in terms of restaurants, I'm not sure what that number, how we rank. Nonetheless, the question was asked once on one of the programs that I produce by two people who were interested in wanting to get into the restaurant business. Why do you want to get into the business? And of course, every answer that came back to this individual, the individual says, wrong. Well, I want to get my old grandmother's cookbook, and I want to make these recipes for the folks and share this and carry on that lane, blah 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 blah. And oh, I want to meet people and have a wonderful connection with the community and so. And of course, this person kept saying, wrong, wrong, wrong. You go into business to make money. As a leader, let's say I want to start a company.
Yep.
I need to have, do I not need to have a goal or a purpose, a reason why I'm going into this business? And is it, as this individual wanted to absolutely assert, that it has to be to make money?
Mm-hmm. I would say no, because making money is only part of the equation. It's not singular, right? If you just want to make money, you're not even going to go in the restaurant business. The margin in the restaurant business is so slim, you know, you're going to go in some other way or franchising or something. You're not going to be making your grandmother's recipes if you want to make money, if that's your only goal, right? I think a more blended approach works better. Nothing says you can't make your grandmother's recipes and make money, right? I was a 25-year coach, and I started a business, and I love what I do. I've been doing it now that long, and I love it, and I can make money at it. It's not mutually exclusive. So I think when you blend a passion for something or an interest or a desire for growing something with a desire to make money, like, hey, we all have to live and making money, nothing's wrong with it. Mm-hmm. But by itself, if you just want to make money, then just go in hedge funds or something in the finance, you know, region. If that's what your passion is, go there.
Yeah, it is one of those I want to say conundrums, because there's this beautiful, I think it's a beautiful story of the not only the power but also the significance and insignificance of money. And I've had a number of programs where we've talked specifically about money.
Mm-hmm.
And the story goes, and I'll keep it short. Two gentlemen, Bob and Frank, and they go out to breakfast. And Bob, at the end of the meal, by the way, they had a great conversation, wonderful food, great atmosphere. Everything was perfect. And the check is brought. Actually, it's not a check. I don't know why they call it a check. It's actually a bill.
Yeah, it's a bill.
But semantics. And Bob reaches into his pocket and pulls out exactly the right amount, and he pays the bill. And they go on their separate ways. Get together for lunch. Exact same scenario. Exact same ending. He pulls out of his pocket exactly the amount of lunch. And they go on their way. Dinner a few weeks later. This time, when Bob pulls the money out of his pocket and pays, which is still exactly the right amount, Frank says, you know, Bob, first of all, I'm very grateful. Thank you so much. I appreciate your picking up the tab the last three times we've been out. I can't thank you enough. But I have one question. How is it that you have exactly the right amount every single time we go out to have these great get-togethers? So he tells Frank the story of how he was cleaning out his garage, came across this really dusty, dirty lamp. He starts cleaning it. You kind of see where this is going. A genie pops out and says, you can have one wish, and you can't wish for more wishes. And he thinks about it. He says, can I get back to you? He says, sure, I'll be here. A couple days later, comes back, says, I know what I want. I wish to have exactly what I need when I need it financially to take care of the things that I need to take care of. And this applied to everything. He says, and that's how I always have the correct amount. And I thought, well, what a great way to live, to where you don't have to worry about whether or not you have enough. You know, you're always going to have enough. You don't need to have six or seven or eight positions before the decimal point in your bank account, because it's always going to be there.
But yes. I mean, I think the U.S. has a bit of a problem with enough. We really don't have a sense of what enough is. And I'll tell you a story as well, because I just came back from a trip to Mexico and I heard this story where there's a fisherman on the beach and a big CEO of a company is coming to a resort there to relax. And he sees the fisherman while he's walking in, and he sees the fisherman pulling in fish every day. So he goes to talk to the fisherman and he says, hey, you know, why don't you get a few more boats? You could bring in a larger haul. And the fisherman's like, yeah, and then what? And then the businessman is like, and then you could start a whole company, you know? And the fisherman says, and then what? And the businessman says, and then you could have a fish processing plant, you know? And this goes on and on until the fisherman says, and then what? And the businessman says, and then you can relax on the beach and do whatever you want. And the fisherman says, that's what I'm doing. Yeah, so we get caught up in like ownership and material things, and we forget like what is really life about. For that fisherman, it's going out, being able to go out fishing every morning. Yeah. Right? For others, we don't know what's really under there that's satisfying, because the old saw about like you can't take it with you when you're in your deathbed. Are you going to be like, yeah, I have X zeros in my bank account? Or are you going to be like, hey, I have people here that I love and love me? Which one's it going to be? It's not going to be the dollar signs.
Yeah. You know, and I think you've said it quite well in that regard, because I know that for myself, and this was something that my late father said to me multiple times, to be honest with you. He said, Richard, find a job you love doing, because you're going to be doing it for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't get stuck like me. Now, when he told me that, this was when he was working for a printing company, when they actually physically typeset and printed checks. He worked for a company called Rocky Mountain Bank Note Company. And they decided they were going to move the facility to Utah. And he was asked if he was going to go with them. And he said no. He did not want to move the family from Phoenix. So he went back to junior college, got his computer programming degree, and he moved on from there with other jobs. And that raises this question. And this, to me, all of this does tie into leadership, because we as individuals, you and I, let's just say you did not own and operate a corporation or a company.
Mm-hmm.
You're just an average Jill as opposed to Jeff.
Yeah.
You're out there working 9 to 5. Sorry, Dolly. You know, you're making it, you know, it may be paycheck to paycheck, but hey, you're still here. You're still alive and thriving. And, you're actually really enjoying what you're doing.
Right.
And For me, I've been doing that since I was 19. Actually, I've been doing that actually since I was 11, because one of my first official jobs was as a paperboy in eighth grade.
Yeah.
And I loved that. I have said this again and again. I'm 64 now, almost 64, I should say. In another month, I will be 64. And if there were any job aside from what I do now that I would ever go back to, if it still existed, it would be that, because number one, I get to work outside, almost get to call my own hours, and I get to meet all kinds of people. That was one of the things that I loved about the job. Plus, I said earlier about being a salesman or not so, I look back at all of the awards that I had won during that 5-year period in my life, of sales awards and trips to Disneyland over and over and over again. And I never actually thought of myself as a salesman then. But as my father said, Richard, you could sell ice cubes to Eskimos. And
you really enjoyed what you were doing. Like, there were so many qualities of that work that you enjoyed. It wasn't about the money. The money is nice to have it, you know, and after you get over survival level, you know, it's nice to have. But interestingly, money is only motivating to a point, right? There's been a lot of research that shows that once you get to a certain level of, you know, ease, let's say with money, where you're not having to sweat it every week that you can pay your bills, money becomes less of a motivator. Mm-hmm. And right now, for young people, their career length is estimated to be 57 years. So that means that age group is going to be working for 57 years. You know, you have to find something that's going to feed you and fulfill you and satisfy you to stay engaged for that length of time. Mm-hmm. You know, if that is money for you because you love numbers or something, great. But if it's not, then being outside or meeting people or relationships or community building or growing something or whatever it is for you, you're going to have to find that thing to literally keep going for that length of time.
You know, that's an interesting point you make, too. I think that my father probably would have worked there until his retirement age at Rocky Mountain Bank Note Company had they not moved the company.
Right.
And I will tell you that I carry some of that longevity in my career because my second job working for the Christian station, I was there for 15 years. Here in Santa Barbara, I have now worked for the same radio station, now under new ownership, we're only about 4 or 5 months under new ownership, for 18 years.
Right. And but guess what? The average tenure of an employee now in the U.S. is 3.5 years. So since the last century and this century, that longevity has dramatically changed. Around the end of 1990s, all the large companies that used to keep workers from post-education through retirement stopped doing that. And now the workforce is very, very fluid, people changing jobs every 2 to 5 years. And because of that, the relationship between the employee and the organization, you know, is not as strong. It's not as connected. Mm-hmm. It's not as valuable. So now organizations are having to find ways to engage in the employees because that deep, you know, lifelong work relationship with you and the company is no longer there.
Yeah.
It's a very fundamental, dramatic change. Like your dad and my dad and pretty much everyone's dad worked at the same company for 20, 30 years.
Yeah. Got the gold watch.
That doesn't happen anymore.
No. And yet at the same time, there will be those, we'll call them anomalies, where, you know, there will be those who actually they do stay somewhere for an extended period of time, but that's going to be a rarity. I would say that I am somewhat of an anomaly in that regard too, because First of all, I have no real desire at this point, although I have goals that don't necessarily include being the operations manager for this station. And one day I will turn the reins over to someone else and I will move on. That brings up this subject about territory, especially.
Before I go back, can we just stay on the old coot subject for a second?
Oh, sure.
Because one reason we stay longer at a job or a company is because we grew up with that in our parents. We saw that as a desirable approach. The younger generations either haven't seen that or are not embracing that, and they are not wanting to stay at the same organization. Like if you look at, say, 35s and under, that stats about their moving around is extremely high. Right. If you look at 50 and older, we tend to be the ones that are going to stay longer and bring that sense of loyalty. It's kind of inbred in us a little bit, but younger folks, you know, they don't have that same kind of sense of loyalty that we had. They grew up differently and they saw all the opportunities out there and they're constantly scanning the horizon for new opportunities and ready to jump at any moment. So there's a very big age difference in terms of longevity at an employer.
Indeed. And that's interesting too, because I have stayed at the positions that I have stayed at out of a mixture of not really wanting to move, you know, it's like, after a period of time, a sense of loyalty, not so much to the company per se, but to my coworkers.
Yes,
because
yes.
Someone else is going to come in there and try to rearrange and undo and so forth, which, hey, it's going to happen whether I like it or not. And when I left that job after 15 years, I knew that whoever was coming in, they were going to do things differently. And I had to make peace with that, which I did. But I think that I'm curious. Does the younger generation have that sense of loyalty at all in the place where they are putting all of their energy? I mean, this is not just a time and effort, but we're putting ourselves. I think about, for example, Steve Jobs and his vision. And then when he passed away, I'm thinking Apple's going down a hill, because that was Steve Jobs' vision. It wasn't the guy who's taken over, unless Steve was able to, shall we say, through osmosis or whatever method, share and transfer that vision to the next person. But at the same time, you know, it's like, hey, the next person's going to have their own vision. You know, will they continue the work that Steve yeah. started, or will they go in a different direction? And of course, hey, it is still extremely successful. So what about
that? Yeah, it's a great example. Apple's a great example of how leadership works, because Steve Jobs had a very particular style of leadership. I actually worked at Apple way back in the day.
Wow.
Cool. And then when he passed the company on, the new CEO had a very different style. But guess what? Sort of the DNA of the organization remained the same. So I think that organizations can instill loyalty by the way they operate, and the leadership at the top can change as long as that culture of the organization remains the same. But what happens, the new leader will come in, they'll actually change the culture of the organization. And then all those people that felt connected to each other in service of the organization leave, because now it's no longer the same entity it had been before. So not that you shouldn't change your culture, but you have to be very careful around that, because if it's been successful, I mean, I think the Apple culture got tweaked a little bit, but it's essentially the same as it was in the beginning. They have a lot of methodologies they use to keep that culture operating. And even though the leadership style is different, the culture is still very similar.
That is also a big issue these days. That phrase that you're using, you know, they refer to it, I think, as the office culture. Now, I had never thought of that before until I heard it. And I'm going, well, I guess you're right. There is a culture within. Now, when I have worked for several stations where I was the only employee, I was running the whole thing. Now, I wasn't doing sales, mind you. I was just keeping us on the air, keeping the programming going, doing the production, working with the programmers, those who were buying time on the station and so forth. So I was it. So it was, I was the culture.
But you know what? You were setting the culture in a way. Just your statements that you said so far, like I think of the other employees as coworkers. I think we're like all in it together. I try to position it for the good of our customers. All of those things are pieces of culture. Their culture is a series of norms that are set up inside the company, some of those spoken and many of those unspoken or unstated. So you were just doing it. You had certain ways you did things, and then other people started doing those things the same way, and it created a culture.
I just, you know, these conversations are so fascinating to me because I have been thinking about these kinds of things since I was 15.
Yeah.
And one area I mean no disrespect to anybody who is extremely pro when it comes to capitalism and free enterprise. But as a 15-year-old delivering newspapers as a paperboy, I began to realize that system is unsustainable. And we're seeing it now, especially here in California. They just raised the minimum wage for fast food workers from whatever it was to $20 an hour. All right. Well, where are you going to get that money? Well, a lot of different places, but one in particular, you're going to raise the cost of your product or service.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So in a year or two, the employees are going to want more because prices keep going up because other companies are doing exactly the same thing. So eventually, a loaf of bread that once cost 99 cents is going to be $500 because it's unsustainable.
Yeah.
You can't keep going down this road. And that's where my story comes in handy, as well as yours, when it comes to what we really need, not what we want, but what we need. And it reminds me of a biblical story from the New Testament where Jesus is trying to calm the disciples who are all shook up over the fact that they're worried about where they're going to get their next meal, where they're going to sleep, what they're going to wear, and so on and so on. And he points to the birds in the trees and says, you see them? They don't work. They don't toil. Okay. And yet, the Creator takes care of them.
Mm.
You are the Creator's children. How much more will the Creator take care of you who He created in His image? All right. And I'll be honest with you, with a lot of the financial challenges that I've been through in my life, I have to remind myself of that hey, in spite of, maybe even because maybe there's a lesson that I'm here to learn. I'm still here. I'm almost 64 and I made it through all of those things.
Yes, yes. So that's, you know, there is a very big faith factor, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what's going to keep people going for 57 years underneath the service, this sort of faith. Whatever that faith is, a faith in a creator, a faith in yourself and your family, a faith in your abilities, a faith, you know, whatever that faith is, mm-hmm. religious and not, is what keeps people going. But Unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to think about it, free will is a factor in there.
Yeah.
And one thing that happened in California is because we didn't raise minimum wage in relation to the increase of cost, we kept it at $7.25 for a very long time and then tried to jump up. And by the way, I think federal is still at $7.25. It's making a massive impact. But if we had been slowly bringing it up over time, so like, you know, the tide rises all the boats, then I don't think it would have had such a big impact. So to me, one of the things is still this community aspect that when we are so focused on ourselves and our own desire for money and not at all looking at the community around us and thinking about spreading the wealth a bit, I think we end up actually hurting ourselves.
We're talking with Lori Maison. She is she's got a website as well as a company, a corporation, Sounding Board Incorporated. SoundingBoardInc.com is her website, SoundingBoardInc.com, I-N-C. We'll be linked to that website, folks, and so folks can find out more about the work that you are doing, as well as the book that we're talking about right now called Leadership Revolution. It is the future development, or I should say the future developing dynamic leaders. The future of developing dynamic leaders is what we're talking about here. And we have about, give or take, 8 to 10 minutes left here. And I wanted to touch upon some of the steps that you go through working with different corporations to help them to move forward in spite of the, I would say, the resistance, because a lot of the old ways of doing things. We talk about this all the time. We're looking for those new ways of living because the old ways don't work. All you have to do is look around you. They aren't working. But you are bringing forth some of those new ways. So what are some of those new ways that you bring to the boardroom table or the conference table when talking about this?
Yeah, got it. One thing you mentioned a little earlier about why you didn't leave one of your organizations was this sense of familiarity. And I do think, why do people keep leading companies and developing leaders in the old way? It's because it's familiar. Like a lot of the work around leader development happened in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And we haven't had very much innovation since then. And so people are familiar with that. They're just doing the same way. Mm. But what's happened now is that work environment has changed so dramatically. The economic environment has changed so dramatically that we have to find new ways to develop leaders. So we do it in a way where you're adding capacities and capabilities. We think skill development is not enough. Just having skills is good when you have a predictable environment, when you know what's going to happen next, you know what skill to apply. But when the environment's unpredictable and you don't know what's coming next, you have to have a deeper well to draw from to be able to be successful in that environment. And interestingly, to your Christian background, much of that is capacity building, which is more an internal job than an external job.
Mm-hmm.
How are you assessing this situation through your own frame of reference? You know, how are you developing up your internal power around yourself so you can do the hard work that's needed? How are you cultivating your internal compass so that you are making, you know, appropriate or, quote, right choices for you in your organization? Mm-hmm. You know, how are you managing energy over time so that you don't burn yourself and everybody else out? Mm-hmm. How are you managing your own belief systems that may be causing conscious or unconscious bias? So those more kind of intangible aspects of leadership are coming to the fore in addition to the tangible ones that we've been doing for a long time. Nothing's wrong with those. They create the foundation, But we're talking now what's on top of that foundation that needs to be more adaptable given how much the work environment has changed in the last 5 years.
And that's one of the things I was going to touch upon too, or have you touch upon, and that is how the working environment has changed since since the whole pandemic thing, because now people are realizing, hey, I don't have to go into brick and mortar. I can do this from home or what have you. I mean, it's really, there's been a huge shift in that regard. And then of course, now you have the introduction of AI, you know, I work with, for example, we're talking here using Zoom, that wants to have me click on the button that says AI companion. And yep. I refuse. I do not need AI's help to do,
Well, you don't need AI companion, right? You probably have companions already. You don't need an official one.
Yeah. And the other aspect of it too, is I know that this is an issue as well, is that, well, but AI will help you to, make fewer mistakes. Well, I'm sorry, but I have always been taught that it is those missteps that actually help us to learn. As a matter of fact, I've asked this question of most of the guests I've had on Talking of Business and so forth. I said, how important is failure? And to a T, every single one of them says it's critical. It's absolutely important, vital. Failure.
I can tell you, you cannot be an exceptional leader if you have not had a substantial failure.
Yeah,
exactly. You cannot. You just don't develop the compassion, the capacity, the self-awareness, the ability to go through hardship. You don't develop that unless you've had some significant failures. And if you look out there at, the visible leaders, you'll see they all have big failures along the way.
Yeah. It's and of course, I personally, just from my own personal philosophy, I am trying to eliminate from my vocabulary the words success and failure. The reason is this. Success and failure, and again, this is not to negate what we have just said about failure. When you start judging those things, you then have to ask yourself the question, well, that star just exploded. Was that a failure on the part of the universe? No, it's just what the universe does. So when I have what we would deem a failure, that's just the way it is. That's part of life in this universe, in this world. And rather than labeling it a failure, I would rather just look at it as, hey, a life lesson, a life.
Agreed. Lesson. One of the things that I talk about in the book is letting go of binary thinking. So success, failure, good, bad. Many people evaluate on those terms, and they don't even know what scale that is, right?
Yeah.
What is good or what is bad? They don't have any evaluation there. So 100% letting go of binary thinking. That binary thinking is a source of a lot of misery for people because human nature skews to the negative. Mm-hmm. So even if others might perceive you as, quote, successful for yourself, you can think you are unsuccessful, right, or failing. So it's just not a good way to evaluate yourself, your life, or anybody else. Non-binary thinking where you have more options than two.
Laurie Maison's my guest. Leadership Revolution is the book, and soundingboardinc.com is the website. And we are so grateful for you sharing with us. I do have three final questions that I ask all of my guests.
Okay.
I'm going to jump right into those right now because we're just about out of time. But I thank you so much for giving us so much time. And I'd love to have you back to continue this conversation because I wanted to get into another area as well. And that is not religious, but the spiritual aspects of leadership. I think that's critical. Yeah. And I'd love to have you back to talk about that.
Oh, I'd love to talk about that.
All right. The three final questions are, number one, who is Laurie Maison?
Who? I don't know. I'm going to say I don't have a singular definition. Lori Maison is just the fullness of Lori Maison. I am who I am.
What gets you up in the morning?
Oh, I am addicted to growth and development. I love growing things, whether it's leaders, children, plants, companies. That is what gets me up in the morning.
And finally, what was your best day?
Oh, my best day is every day. I actually enjoy something in every single day that I'm alive, and I just feel grateful to be here in our old coot stage, you know, still alive and kicking. And I enjoy every day.
Lori Maison, once again, thank you so much for joining us. And I thank you for listening to and watching Tell Me Your Story. New paradigms for a new world, where we're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until our next broadcast, podcast, videocast, love to Lal. Jeanette, I am still listening. Dad, continue to be happy because I am. Hey, Smokey, I'll see you on the other side. To my dear friend Zorro. Aho. Aho.